This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is David Mas Masumoto, a third-generation farmer who grows certified organic peaches, nectarines, grapes, and raisins with his family on their 80-acre farm near Fresno, California. David is the award-winning author of Epitaph for a Peach and several other books, columnist for the Fresno Bee, spokesperson for organic farming, and a fellow at the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Mas Masumoto is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land, published in 2009 by the Free Press. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. What led you to write Wisdom of the Last Farmer?
It began in 1997 when my father had a major stroke. The first chapter describes the scene where I found him behind our shed and he was disoriented walking around the tractor. And it depicts the scene of him trying to find himself and at the same time struggling with obviously this condition that he found himself in. From that beginning point, it was a question of would my dad survive? But the major question was, would he be able to farm after that? We'd been farming together for over a decade at that point, and the roles that we had to undergo, the changes, it motivated me to want to write something about the changes that were occurring, not just about his stroke, but what does it mean to be a farmer, and also what were some of those lessons, that wisdom that my dad had that he would pass down to me, or I would have to rethink and reexamine that sort of wisdom in context of present-day farming, too.
Would you like to say a few words about your family farm and its history?
My grandparents immigrated from Japan at the beginning of the 1900s, and they were farm workers for most of their lives. There were very racist alien land laws throughout the western states, especially in California, that prevented them from ever owning land. And these were laws specifically targeting Orientals at that time, and it was aimed at Japanese Americans. The public didn't want them to buy land. So my grandparents were farm workers. We bought our farm after World War II and, of course, after the relocation of Japanese Americans from the West Coast. I was born after that time, but my parents and grandparents spent 4 years behind barbed wire in the middle of the Arizona desert. It was their price that they paid because they looked like the enemy. My parents and family came back from that experience to the area of Fresno, California, right in the middle of the state, small towns just south of that, and my dad bought a farm. He had been renting land, and he bought a farm and said that even though in America they may not treat you as Americans, he was going to find a way to carve a niche in this land for himself and our family, and that's how our farm began around 1948.
You mentioned in your book that you didn't take agriculture courses in college. What made you decide to return to your farm after college and become a farmer?
Probably because I never took agricultural courses. I, growing up, did not want to be a farmer. At the end of high school, I distinctly remember telling my dad that I would never come back to the farm, and I probably hurt him very badly then. That's what very immature young people do, especially immature young teenage boys do. And I told my dad I'd never come back to the farm. So I ran away for college and I went to UC Berkeley because I knew it would be radical enough that my parents wouldn't ever want to come and visit me nor question me about what I was going to do. And I never studied agriculture because I thought if I studied agriculture, it would be a sign that I was thinking of returning to the farm. So I studied sociology because I thought, how many farmer sociologists are there in the world? The irony is, of course, that training as a sociologist and that experience of doing work in the social sciences did bring me back to the farm because I began to see the farm more than just planting things in the ground and growing things. It was much more, not only the lifestyle, but also what was the role of small family farms in America? How does organic farming, which when I came back to the farm I started to do, how does that fit within that larger fabric of both the economics of food farming and also the social structure in terms of what is the role of farms, what is the role of farmers in our society and our food system? Those are the type of things that brought me back to the farm. And ironically, it was because I didn't study agriculture.
What do you find most satisfying about being a farmer?
Probably the ability to work with nature and truly work with nature, not trying to control nature. I enjoy being out in the fields, and it's a constant struggle. It's very hard physical work. I like to call it honest work because you can't take a lot of shortcuts out in the fields. It tends to come back and bite you right back later because if you try to, you know, think, well, those weeds, I'm going to just conveniently ignore them. They find a way to remind you of their existence about 2 months later when they're not little weeds anymore. They're giant weeds. I enjoy that kind of direct, authentic contact with the earth, with plants that they grow, and the idea of only harvesting something once a year. The idea that you have to put in that time and energy and spiritual connection to try to say, I'm going to try to grow something that's wonderful, hopefully that's well received. And if I mess up, it's part of the work of working with nature, and you look toward the next harvest. So that kind of direct relationship for me is very important.
What are some specific examples of how farming gives you a concrete sense of place?
Farms don't move. When I decided to come back to the farm, I remember telling friends, here's my address for the rest of my life. That's not heard very often, the idea that you're going to stay in one place for the rest of your life. And part of that, too, is this wonderful demarcation where I'm planted in this ground. When I got married, my wife, who grew up on a goat dairy, by the way, she knew she was going to spend the rest of her life there. There's something about that both has this wonderful spiritual quality because you're anchored, you're grounded, you're rooted. It also has this other sense because in our society today, mobility tends to be rewarded. If you want to achieve something, you have to be willing to go where the job is, go where the profession is, go where the interest is. I can't quite do that. So there is this kind of double-sided coin, so to speak. That sense of place anchors you, but it also could weigh down on you like a burden. I accept both because they come with that territory. To me, that is what sense of place means. It means you're going to be someplace for a long time, and you know that, so that it changes how you make decisions. Because I know I'm going to be farming this land forever, I start building up the soil. Because it's not just for this harvest or next year's, it's for the rest of my life. Because I'm going to stay on this land, I also could do long-term experiments, so to speak. So when I plant a new variety of peaches where I'm not sure how they're going to turn out, I have a lifetime to figure that out. To me, that's what a sense of place is all about. And also, a sense of place means the relationship I have literally with the earth, with the dirt, is reflected in the flavor of our peaches, nectarines, and raisins, so that if I take care of the earth and feed it properly, the trees are going to enjoy that, and hopefully that results in this wonderful sweetness in our fruits. I think that sense of terroir is very important, and it's part of what we do as small farmers when we plant ourselves in certain places.
I'm Diane Horn, and we're speaking with Mas Masumoto, organic farmer and author of the book, Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What do you find most difficult about being a farmer? What are the challenges?
Probably there's two things. One is certainly the marketplace. We do all this work and then we're at the mercy of the market to tell us what kind of price we're going to get. It's one of the few professions where you never set your price early. You do all the work up front and then say, okay, would you please give me some money for this? And it's a challenge because that economic sustainability is very important because I could do everything right environmentally. I could do everything right in terms of social justice, but if I can't make a go of it on the farm economically, I'll go out of business. So you need those three elements, the environmental, the social justice, and the economic in order to stay in business and to continue what we do. I think that's one of the biggest challenges. The other challenge has to do with something, especially as I get older, and I'm 55, and ironically, I'm still a young farmer because the average age of farmers are like in their late 50s, early 60s, which means then I'm always the younger guy out there, even as I age. It's kind of wonderful in one sense, but it's also scary because you don't have a lot of young farmers taking over the land. The other part of the challenge, I think, has to do with that hard physical work that really takes a toll on your body. And that's when I try to capture in Wisdom of the Last Farmer, because it documents my father's stroke. And what did it mean for us as farmers who do work that's very physical? What does it mean when you have a new physical disability that enters into the equation? You know, does he become obsolete? Do I have to redefine him? Does he have to redefine himself? How do we find work for him that's meaningful on the farm so he has a sense of an identity? Those are all stories, challenges that I document in Wisdom of the Last Farmer, but it also reflects that challenge of hard physical work. And I don't think you could get away from that when you really farm and really work the earth. Certainly you could buy equipment, you could use modern technology. Often, the more I do that, the further it pushes me away from the land and the earth, and that's the exact opposite relationship I want to do. So that to farm well, I do think you have to have that physical bond with the land, with the plants, the trees, the vines, but also takes a physical toll, too.
What are some of the specific challenges in growing heirloom organic peaches?
A couple things. There's a reason why farmers on a commercial level don't grow like in certain heirloom varieties of peaches. And I've learned those after I plant them. It's part of the very challenging learning curve you go through. Oftentimes you'll find that the fruit set is irregular, the size isn't consistent, the appearance could be challenging, to say the least, at times. And also other things such as marketability. They may not have a very even coloration. They may sometimes bruise easily. These are the challenges that I'm always faced with in trying to farm these heirloom varieties. It's odd because it's almost as if I have to relearn the lessons my dad and my grandfather did when they planted something, decided it wasn't going to work, and yanked it out. And here I am, you know, decades, generations later, doing the same thing. But it's also part of that learning curve. And the fun challenge is trying to figure out, well, how can I make a go of this? Maybe we could pick this slightly differently. If I do different cultural practices, will that affect things? And understand weather patterns and how they have that very profound effect on how things grow, especially these heirloom varieties, which are very demanding in that sense. A lot of the newer varieties were bred specifically because they were easier to take care of. And easier to take care of is they were probably more forgiving in terms of pest control, water, things of that sort. Well, these heirlooms are very demanding. On the other hand, that's exactly the kind of farming I want to do, because I want to hopefully be rewarded to spend that many hours of monitoring, the hours of management, and be rewarded for being as conscientious of a farmer as I am.
Well, in a sense, you've been alluding to this, but would you say more about how the rise of industrialized agriculture changed the criteria by which peaches were judged?
There's a chapter in Wisdom of the Last Farmer where I talk specifically about this. And ironically, there is a parallel in the 1950s when color TV was introduced, and the idea that suddenly the world became colorized. It's almost like when you look at The Wizard of Oz and the first scenes of Dorothy in Kansas are in black and white, and when she lands in Oz, the world comes alive with color. It's color, but it was a manipulated color, if you think about it. The colors that you saw on TV and continue to see today, they're somewhat artificial. Certain colors work on a studio set. They have to have intense light to bring out certain colors. But we became trained with pretty much seeing, you know, a red is a red and a yellow is a yellow, as if all reds are good and all yellows are good, but you can't blend them. That's not very natural. Most colors in nature run a spectrum where you have a variety in shades and hues and different tones of reds and yellows and oranges, and that's what peaches are. So as we began to change our sense of color and our relationship with color, basically consumers began to see red is better, so that a redder peach must be riper. And you go to the store today and many people will still think, I want that red peach because it must be better. Well, farmers responded to that. The industry responded to that, and they said, okay, you want red peaches? We will grow red peaches. And so suddenly a lot of nurseries started developing redder and redder fruit. Heirlooms began to fall to the wayside because they didn't fit this newer industrial model of what a peach should look like. And we're exactly part of that. Saw that the market was going in a certain direction. When I wrote Epitaph for a Peach, it was specifically about a peach variety we grew called Suncrest, which was an older peach that had this wonderful golden hue to it when it was ripe, but it wasn't lipstick red. And this peach became homeless in the marketplace because it didn't have that cosmetic qualities. That, I think, was how the industry began to shift, and it's one example that I document in Wisdom of the Last Farmer about the industry started shifting simply because we began to look at red differently.
Would you mention also the USDA inspectors and their color chips?
As a result of the farming becoming more like a business, in the 70s, the industry was struggling, well, if the consumers want red, what is a red peach? So they began to develop these, they call them color chips, which were these little cards, maybe about an inch by inch square, with different shades from yellow, oranges to red on them. And they began to assign a peach must be ripe when it reaches this shade of red. And suddenly that became the indicator of what was right versus what was wrong. And this was sort of artificial. Someone, you know, the industry said, this is the color people want. This is what this fruit should be before you pick it. And it was wild. It was an insane time because these color chips and the inspection agency could stop you from picking, saying your fruit isn't ripe because it's not red enough. And I witnessed and I was involved with arguments saying, but this year, the weather patterns, for example, if we had a fairly cool spring, the reds may not be as pronounced as a warm spring. It wasn't going to be the typical red. Nope. The industry said, this is what red and ripe is supposed to be. And you'd have battles with these inspectors because, for example, when the fruit ripens unevenly, maybe a part of the fruit, maybe the very tip or one of the shoulders or something along the suture ripens a little earlier and could get soft. So you have to pick it or the fruit's going to get too soft and bruised. But if part of that fruit wasn't red enough to meet the color chip requirement, the inspector could stop you from picking. It's happened to us, it happened to my neighbors, and it was a crazy system, but it was part of this chase that the industry had because they began to lust red. It's almost like a historical romance novel where everyone was lusting after this red, and it started literally changing farms, farmers, and the crops that they grew. Fortunately, today, it's shifted back. There are only a few people use color chips as the criteria anymore. I think it had to do with the changing marketplace, and I think it had to do with a lot of farmers starting to grow different heirloom varieties and realizing these have just as much valid place in the marketplace as this kind of Hollywood lipstick red peach does too.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Mas Masumoto, organic farmer and author of the book Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land. Who are your current customers for your organic heirloom peaches?
They vary. We certainly sell much local into the Bay Area and the Los Angeles. Our farm is in Fresno, California, which is right in the middle of the state. Actually, a very nice location to be at. And there's sort of these concentric circles of our market, so to speak. We ship a lot up into the Northwest, Portland and Seattle area along the West Coast. But a lot of our peaches do travel to the Midwest and the East Coast. It depends on the year, depends on the quality. Every year is slightly different. And it wonderfully depends on a sense of history. We sell a lot of peaches into the Minneapolis-St. Paul, Twin Cities area. And the reason why was early in the late 1980s when we were certified organic, trying to find homes for these wonderful fruits. There are 7 food co-ops in the Twin City areas. These have been around for decades, for generations. This kind of marketing of food was different. They took a personal relationship, being a co-op and also being run by members. They understood this relationship that they wanted to form. So when our peaches arrived there, they said, we like the story behind these peaches, and we've always had a consistent relationship with them, and they've been a delight to work. Those are the markets for our fruit where they go throughout the United States.
In your book, you state that farming is a cultural act. Would you explain?
I think the mistake a lot of large corporate farms make is that they begin to look at farming as a monolith. And usually it's economic. It's a business model that, you know, this is all about making money. So everything you do is to maximize profits, create more efficiencies. So then the greater efficiencies you could have in a shorter amount of time, the better. I don't think that fits nature and working with things that grow in the earth. I think there's a very different way of looking at that, and that's what we try to do on our farm. Try to look at working with nature, and it's not just a model of efficiencies and economics. We do pay attention to that because this isn't a hobby that I'm trying to do. This is my profession. This is our profession for our family. It's trying to weave into that the environmental, the social justice issues, and the economic. That's the model that we're trying to achieve.
What qualities make a good farmer?
One of the things I think that makes a good farmer is that they have to have a passion for what they do. And that passion could be in many different ways. It could be a, you know, very private passion and, you know, you bond with your land. It could be a spiritual one in that sense. It could be one that's very social where you see your farm as part of a larger community, a local community, or a broader regional community. You have to have passion more than anything. And I think that's true with almost any profession. You have to have that passion to get you through the tough times. In Wisdom of the Last Farmer, there's a Japanese parable that goes like this: fall down 7 times, get up 8. In order to get up 8 times, in order to overcome failures, in order to overcome that struggle, that hard physical work, you have to have that passion to get up that one extra time. That's part of the wisdom that I write about in Wisdom of the Last Farmer that my dad passed down to me. He was not a very verbal man. He was very stoic in many ways, but he did have that passion that I witnessed growing up and working side by side and then later helping him to heal. That was that passion that I try to capture in my writing, and it's the passion I think that makes a good farmer.
What changes have you seen in the other farms in your area over time?
A couple things. One, there's a growing aging farm population, which worries me tremendously. We grow raisins and we're part of Sunmade, which is a cooperative. And the average age of the Sunmade farmer is about 68, I believe. It's an old profession in the sense that there's a lot of small farmers still hanging in there. I think that's wonderful. What worries me is that what's going to happen when they no longer farm? Is there a generation of younger farmers? I think there is, because there's certainly interest out there. And I'm very refreshed to see that. And one of the challenges or one of the new opportunities might be, I have a 23-year-old daughter who is planning on taking over the farm, and I think it's wonderful. It makes me feel young to have that kind of continuity. And also, she brings with her that perspective of younger people and a different way of looking at things, where there are many of these younger farmers are come from an environmental viewpoint. And I think that's so healthy, because if they're coming from an economic one and are expecting to make a lot of money, I tell them good luck, and I think they'll probably fail. Because you have to come in again with that passion, with something very different, in order to find a niche to where you belong. The farms around me are changing in that they're aging and they're looking for a different model. Our part of the state of California, a lot of the farms are still fairly small. Farmers still live on the land, and that's very unique and very important because they're part of that fabric of the community and that rural social structure when you live on the land. That's starting to change, and that does worry me a lot. I think that's probably the biggest change that I'm witnessing around me.
Do you think the qualities that will make a good farmer in the future will be different from those now or in the past?
Yes and no. I still think that that idea of passion and willing to do hard work is going to be universal, probably universal in almost every profession, but especially with agriculture, because you have to expect that you're going to do this hard physical work. The thing that is changing, though, is a younger generation, as I said, is coming in with an environmental perspective and one that actually embraces technology much easier than my generation. You know, does that mean that I'm going to use global tracking systems to drive my tractor? No. Does it mean that I'm going to rely on, you know, Twitter and all these new social networking sites to market my peaches? Maybe, but I won't. It'll probably be my daughter that will understand that, and how that notion of social capital enters into the picture of what we're doing. And that's a new type of dynamic. The social capital farmers used to deal with in the past were the neighboring farmers you had and you interacted with them as friends, or the brokers that you worked with. It was a very narrow spectrum of relationships you had. It's exchanging tremendously now. I think embracing the new technological advances could only help that. For example, revamped our website on it. Why? Because I realized people want to know more about the foods that they eat, and I, as a writer, need to tell my story even more, not only in my books, but also on things like our website. So with the help of my daughter, we finally did revamp it. And she actually changed it in a very different way, because we had a fairly traditional, simple website, you know, posted the things that we grow, a little bit our bios and things like that. She goes, no, Dad, I think we need to divide our website so when you look at it, you see the four or five farms that we do. And the farms are the idea of a family farm and the history of our family on it. But also the idea of the natural farm, our pursuit of organics and the history of us farming, working with nature. But also the public farm, which involves issues that we struggle with, such as social justice issues, issues swirling around us that involve public policy. And of course, the literary farm that has my writings out, all of it. And my daughter was right. I think that was a way of reframing our farm in a way that people could see the work that we do and understand this is the type of farm that we have. And hopefully all this contributes to the flavor someone would enjoy when they eat our peaches, nectarines, or raisins.
What is your perspective of the farm workers you hire to work on your land and their situation?
It's a struggle. My family, my grandparents were farm workers. My parents were farm workers. I was raised on a farm, and I remember talking with city friends, and I had some city cousins, and they say, what are you going to do during the summer? And it was like, well, doesn't everybody work during this? It was a given from being a little kid. I think because I've worked on this farm my whole life, I've developed a different relationship and a sensibility about workers that come to the farm, and farm workers especially. It's always a constant struggle. Why? Because we don't necessarily make tons of money in order to pass down profits. We actually have set up a kind of bonus program on our farm that we share with some of the workers, and I think it's marvelous. But the challenge is the economics of it doesn't always warrant that we could pay higher wages. And it's probably the biggest thing I struggle with in what we do. Because there's this driving force of how do you reward people for the work that they do and reward them in many ways, but the economics always comes as a big issue in trying to pay people a just living wage, and it's a challenge.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That when you eat food, try to think of the person, the family, the people behind the food that you're eating, and also the story that goes with it. I always thought that if my peaches work, they're no longer just my peaches, but they fuse together with the people who are eating them and their whole memory and their legacy. That's what I try to capture in my writings in Wisdom of the Last Farmer. That's that connection that we have with food, not only in terms of its taste, but also that sense of history, and also that bittersweet harvest of something wonderful, knowing that the hard physical work behind it is all part of eating a real peach or eating a real nectarine.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Moss.
Oh, thank you. A pleasure.
We have just been speaking with Moss Masumoto, organic farmer and author of Wisdom of the Last Farmer, Harvesting Legacies from the Land, published in 2009 by the Free Press, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. For more information, check on the web at www.masumoto.com. Again, that's masumoto.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.